Afghanistan struggles at the World Cup, East Asia Pacific's under-19s craziness, and T20 World Cup regional qualifiers all over the planet. All that and more in the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world. Episode 12 today. After a brief hiatus, we have our full complement again. Tim Cutler in Brisbane. Tim, what have you been up to?
Trying to keep up with everything. All this cricket going on. Apparently there's some kind of event going on in the UK. I'm not sure what's going on. It seems to be quite wet and no reserve days. But yeah, it's exciting times. Bez, how about you?
Oh, good. Just coming back from another international trip. I was lucky enough to go to India and the Maldives with a brief stopover in Singapore on the way home. And after surviving India and not being sick in that entire trip, I managed to get sick probably on the plane home, managed to pick up a bit of a flu in the last sort of 7 days or so. So that's a bit disappointing. But to move on, Copernicus Cricket, we also have here the man known by many as Copernicus Cricket on Twitter, Nick Skinner. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Bez. Nothing as exciting as a trip to the Maldives to report, though, unfortunately.
Oh, my goodness. It is magical. I recommend it to anyone willing to travel overseas. A few nights there, 4 days in total. Oh, yeah. Didn't really want to come home.
Did you see the news recently where they had the Maldives Prime Minister, I think, or President at the IPL? There's been a bit of to and fro. They're trying to get the BCCI to help out developing cricket there.
Yeah, I did briefly look at that and I did see the Maldives cricket governing body get a bit of a mention. I also saw that Modi, who's just been re-elected as the leader of India, is set to visit the Maldives, you know, I guess the sort of vice versa trip. So who knows, maybe some cricketing chat there. I'm not too sure. We will get into the actual cricket though, and mind you, Tim's bemoaned the World Cup, its structure and sort of everything that goes with it. And as much as we'd like to agree, Emerging Cricket does have, I guess, a participant in the World Cup in Afghanistan. But you have to say it's been a monumental disaster, basically from, well before the tournament, really, with the sacking of Asghar Afghan as captain. They've managed to lose all three of their games. They looked okay in the warm-ups and then they fell to Australia by 7 wickets. They bottled a really good chance to beat Sri Lanka and then they had another disappointing performance against New Zealand. We've seen Mohammad Jazad go home injured. That's in quotation marks because he believes he isn't injured and it's more about favouritism in the squad. There's been talk of Simmons as head coach and being offered a new contract. There's new selectors. Rashid Khan was concussed in the last game. It's basically all gone pear-shaped for the Afghans so far in this World Cup. Nick, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so it has, as you said, just been a complete mess, really. I remember when we were in Namibia and our good friend Bertus de Jong was struggling to write his preview for the squad and we were going through the lineup that they'd released and there were, you know, we were scratching our heads over some of the selections, you know, guys that had sort of not played for a few years and guys who hadn't really been performing on the domestic level and, you know, and of course the Asghar Afghan being stripped of the captaincy and just all the I guess drama off the field and the behind the scenes stuff seems to be really bubbling over now. And I guess Mohammad Shahzad being given the Timothy Khauta's treatment, it's all a bit of a mess. And I think it goes to show that Afghanistan have a lot of talent on the field, but in terms of administration, they still have a long way to go if they're going to move up the rankings in a consistent way.
Yeah, we've talked about it in the past, haven't we, of the juxtaposition of Ireland and Afghanistan, where Ireland, well, I guess despite a recent hiccup, which we'll get to later off the field, are very well set up from an administrative point of view, but potentially don't have the cattle at the moment coming through. We talked about Afghanistan of having the talents on the field and coming through, but not necessarily in administration. I think it's the chickens have come home to roost, as Billy Boucher's mother said in Waterboy. In the
vintage comedy reference there, Tim.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's up there at the top of the list actually for me. If you go to movies, but yeah, you sack your CEO. Some interesting decisions selection wise. then you sack your captain weeks out from a World Cup and then drop your captain. And remember us talking about him and the role he played during the Ireland series and Derradun, about how important to have that experience down the order was. And just looking at Twitter now, they've now appointed a new selection panel, including Andy Moles, who's working there, is coaching the under-19s team and whatnot. They've appointed a woman to the board, I think, as well, which is the first woman I think we've seen on the ACB, and also a special committee unnamed to look after the Afghanistan Premier League. So interesting to be naming these things during the World Cup. It's not like the sort of bill you put through Parliament at sort of 8:30 on a Friday night or during State of Origin or something, so people don't notice it. But yeah, I don't know. It really disappoints me for what cricket is to Afghanistan, and to see the administration, well, I don't know, that the lack of support perhaps for the players coming through there is concerning for us that loves to see stories like this in Afghanistan, to be a non-Commonwealth country, to cricket making such a difference in a war-torn nation as it is. And then to see this is, I don't know, heartbreaking, really.
Yeah, well, Afghanistan, the cricket board have basically said to Mohammad Shahzad, you can't be playing no cricket with your friends, Mohammad Shahzad, in reference to the water boy there. Yeah, the wheels, I guess, fell off before the tournament even started for them. And yeah, given all these shuffles at the sort of the back rooms, it does make you think that everything's a bit of a mess. And you look at someone like Gulbuddin Nayib leading a one-day international team, and I've got to say, he just looks a little bit lost, to be honest. I mean, I would have sort of earmarked him as someone who was actually lucky to be in the team full stop, and then they gave him the captaincy, and it's been a disaster. Nick, you were going to sort of talk about Mohammad Shahzad.
Yeah, I remember last year he was given an ultimatum by the board, actually, to basically to force him back into Afghanistan, because he was living in Peshawar in Pakistan, where he'd grown up, I guess, most of his life in a refugee camp. And I think he also got a fine because he was playing in a local league there without the permission from the board. So there's definitely some tension going back a little while with Shahzad. But yeah, I mean, it seems pretty stupid to be sending him home given how important he is with the bat at the top of the order there.
Well, he has failed so far in the campaign with the bat, and you'd have to say that, you know, his dropping would have been warranted given his failures, but to be sent home, as he alleges, is another kettle of fish. It'll be interesting to see what sort of pans out after this, but it doesn't look clean at all. And yeah, only time will tell. As for time, well, it should tell for poor old Papua New Guinea in the under-19s East Asia Pacific World Cup qualifiers.
They'll be doing time if they're not careful.
Yes. Well, they've found themselves in some hot water. How do we go about this, boys? Because first of all, Japan have qualified for the under-19s Cricket World Cup, which is a huge achievement and a huge story coming out of the East Asia Pacific region. And you have to feel, you know, elated for them. But the story's coming out from Papua New Guinea. Who wants to deliver the news here? Tim, do you want to go? You've been speaking to some sources over the past few days.
Okay. Well, believe whilst reviewing the results early on in the tournament, and very similar to the East Asia Pacific women's qualifier that's just been, you can see that the best teams, or at least the teams that ICC thought were going to be best, were set up to play against each other on the last day. We saw Samoa up against PNG in the women's tournament, and in the men's tournament it was Japan and PNG who came into the last day undefeated.
Yes, yeah, some good scheduling there, I have to say.
No, absolutely, and it's great to come down to a de facto final when you have only a single round robin like that. It's great. You know, these are semi-professional, if not amateur players. They're probably taking time off work to be there, let's be honest, so that the shorter the tournament and punchy, the better, and how they schedule it, perfect. So we're all excited about this game and how it was going to run, and I think we all woke up, or at least saw in the morning, the tweet from, I don't know what was first, Japan or was it EAP?
Well, there was a press release from Jane, just very tersely worded, just saying that they'd forfeited because they couldn't field a team, basically.
Exactly that, and they could not field an eligible team. So I think originally the thought was, well, what's happened? If they've all found to be overage and they've been given the option to forfeit before being disqualified, or so nobody knew anything. And I think, I guess, as you said, with the sources bubbling around, some very close to the matter, it would appear that overnight before that final game, basically the long and the short of it is 11 of the players were arrested or at least taken into custody on suspicion of shoplifting. And the details of which are still up in the air, but we've had multiple sources confirm this, and this meant that they weren't actually even available to come to the ground because they were still with the police. So even if the team wanted them to play, obviously the management wanted them to, they wouldn't have been able to. So they literally had to forfeit because 11 of the squad of 14 were still locked up. I think somewhere there's laughing, there's crying, there's tears, definitely, because it's just beyond, I don't know, Nick, what do you think? Where's that up there in the terms of dumbest things done on tour?
It's got to be at least in the top five, if not. I mean, it's genuinely the dumbest thing I've ever heard of happening on tour. I just cannot get my head around 11 PNG cricketers in regional Japan going shoplifting. Just where do you even begin? It's like a Monty Python sketch, isn't it? The whole cricket team tries to shop. Like, were they all in the same shop, or were they? The mind boggles, honestly. And I guess you do feel for them, because I mean I've done some pretty stupid things in the past, and you know, lucky enough not to get in too much trouble. But I don't know where to even begin with this.
Well, lucky they don't arrest people for oiling their cricket bat before they sand it.
Oh, here we go.
I was waiting for that.
Otherwise, we would have someone on the other side, on the other end of the line, saying, "You've only got 5 minutes, and you're not allowed to talk about what it's like in jail." Sorry, drill sergeant.
I can get your stuff, Nick. I can get your stuff.
I believe you're a man who knows how to get things.
Give me some linseed oil, mate.
Yeah. Well, the thing for me is, like, in Japan, they don't treat something like this lightly. I've heard a few stories where you can be detained for up to about 3 weeks without outside communication and stuff like that. And yeah, as you said, Nick, it's the last place you'd want to try anything like this. It has to be the most technologically savvy country in the world. Surely the CCTV there is actually being filmed by more than a potato, which seems to be how all other CCTV is being filmed, where you look at the footage in Australia and you're like, I can't make out who any of those people are. How are you expecting me to identify who these people are?
To be fair, I think they're probably the only PNG nationals in Sano at the moment, so it wouldn't be hard to identify them even on the potato quality CCTV.
that's just another way, another reason why this looks even more foolish. I mean, yeah, as you said, Tim, there's probably a lot of crying and a lot of sadness going around that camp at the moment. But for people who have followed a lot of sport and seen, you know, not only dumb injuries but dumb indiscretions off the field, you know, this is honestly like right up there. I've seen a couple of like shoplifting stories in college sports in the US before they turn into the pros, because they have, you know, you don't get paid in college sport. But yeah, to this, I guess, level.
Yeah, to have all 11 of them at once.
Yeah. And the kind of ironic thing was, Nick, you picked up on it, was that they have like a silly hat for like, I guess it's like a donkey shirt where you give it to someone in the team who's done something stupid, and they have to wear a hat for, I don't know, a few hours or until someone else does something stupid. Unfortunately, you can't divide the stupid hat into 11 pieces, because that's kind of where my mind's going at the moment.
Yeah, they're going to need 11 silly hats, because that's...
So what I want to know is there someone right now sitting down writing a movie script about this crack team brought together to rob a casino in Sano? Well, what would you call it?
Pacific Ocean's 11.
But, I mean, if we are looking again at positives, it's between Japan and Nigeria both qualifying for the Cricket World Cup at under-19 level is something that I don't think anyone would have predicted, let alone in the same tournament held next year in South Africa. It's going to be an incredible tournament, and I'm pretty sure that the TV rights will be up for that, and a lot of these guys will be shown on television for the first time. And just what a chance for exposure and stuff like that, having two nations that, you know, when you think of cricket and you think of countries that play cricket, they're not exactly two countries that come top of mind. But For people, I guess, outside the bubble of emerging cricket, Tim, to see these two countries playing in a Cricket World Cup can only be good for the exposure of cricket in wider regions and ultimately wider audiences as well.
Well, what can we say? We've got Nigeria with 200 million people, or about to tip over 200 million people, well, football mad nation with a big gap to number two, and then Japan, 126 million people. And if you need a parallel story, it's Rugby World Cup 2015, where fewer than 100,000 people watched their game against South Africa, their huge victory, and then, you know, over 25 million people watched their next game against Samoa. So I'm not sure if we need to come up with any other reasons there to say that this is why regional qualifying, well, there's an argument for regional qualifying because it means teams like this have a chance to make it and will make it, and maybe they wouldn't in a global league. And I know that we've got a lot of Nepalese fans listening to the podcast who are probably thinking that Nepal, after missing out on Duckworth Lewis Stern in the wet in Malaysia, to see UAE go through and how the Nepal team would go against Japan. So I guess there's discussion there about whether it's about having the best teams there or regional representation. And that's a discussion perhaps for another day. But for one, despite the disappointment of the PNG team missing out, I couldn't be happier to see nations like Japan and Nigeria for different reasons, but both really exciting.
Yeah, pretty much agree with Tim there. You raise an interesting point with the notion of regional qualification versus, I guess, just the best teams. But I think, as you point out, it is, I guess, it's good to get a variety of teams in and try and get maybe a foothold in some of these new markets that we're looking at. And I don't expect Japan to suddenly, 25 million Japanese to be watching the under-19s cricketers. But, if even it gets to 25,000 viewers, or that'd be a pretty good start. So I think just being on the world stage is such a great advertisement for the game. And this is, I guess, goes back to the 50 over World Cup that's currently going on with only 10 teams, and the decision to kick them out for the ostensibly so that you can have more competitive games, but we all know how that's nonsense. But anyway, the problem is that by kicking out these teams, you deprive yourself of the opportunity to advertise the game to potentially new markets. And I guess as rugby in Japan, I think, is a very good example of a sport investing in promoting the game and reaping the rewards, as they sort of take a long-term view. And, Japan have been rubbish, honestly, at rugby for years and years and years before they scored that upset against South Africa. But now, you get millions of people tuning in to watch them, and the game's sort of taking off a bit there. And it all it takes is, one result like that, or, as we saw with Ireland against Pakistan in the 2007 Cricket World Cup, it just takes that one upset to really spark the game's growth. And that's what the ICC is depriving itself of, really. And it's hurting cricket overall. It's not just sad for the teams that miss out. It's sad for cricket around the world, because it means that we'll have less of these, development stories going forward.
Well, that just reminded me of Kyle Kurtzer, MBE, by the way. Congratulations to Kyle. He discussed the 1999 World Cup as his sort of inspiration of playing cricket, because he saw Scotland play in that tournament, and that was his sort of first memory of Scottish cricket and being motivated to play international cricket for his country. And, well, it's got him an MBE. And so once again, sort of congratulations to our emerging cricket ambassador, Kyle Kurtzer. But let's, I guess, sort of profile a couple of these Japanese players who have achieved great things with the under-19 team. Marcus Thurgate, the captain, also led with the bat. I think he topped the run charts with a couple of 50s. I think he's the keeper as well. And then they had quite a handy bowling attack. Nick, you discussed in our pre-recording guys like Takahashi and Morita, taking wickets for him consistently over the course of the tournament.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Their bowling attack, I remember when we were talking about Nigeria's bowling attack, there were a few guys in there who were sort of sharing the wickets around. And it was the same thing with Japan. So, Kazumasa Takahashi, he got a 4 for 14 against Samoa. Masato Morita, a leg spinner, got 4 for 38 against Vanuatu. And an off-spinner, Uganda Retoreka, took 5 for 18 against Fiji. So they all kind of stepped up to lead the attack at various points, and that's going to sort of put them in good stead, is having a few different bowling options, because, you look at, say, for example, Vanuatu and Edwell Kalfo. He took 8 for 18, absolutely wrecked Samoa, and he also picked up wickets in the other games. And he topped the wicket tally by a long way. He was on 15 wickets, but they didn't really have anyone else to back him up. And so that's, I guess, what's going to make the difference between a team that's able to challenge against more fancied teams in the under-19 World Cup there, and maybe a team that, if you rely too much on, one player or two players, you're going to struggle. So seeing them have such a, I guess, depth in their bowling is very encouraging. And of course, Marcus Thurgate as well with the bat. He's played senior cricket for them for a couple of years now. So he's certainly going to be key as well, I think, going into the World Cup under-19s.
Okay, I'll start again. And before you segue on, Bez, that the Thurgate name for me is a famous one for Japanese cricket, where his father Chris has toured with the team before to Hong Kong to umpire, actually, during the East Asia Cup. And Marcus, half Japanese, born and bred in Japan. I guess it's great to see, well, even a bit of a sort of more multicultural feel to the Japanese team, just showing how that cricket community is developing there and coming through the system. I think very encouraging, as hopefully a lot of these guys can hang around and aren't going off overseas for school or anything like that. But great to see these kids come through the system.
Yeah, just on that, they do have a selection policy where they do try and mostly pick teams that are produced through the Japanese system, and that's not necessarily a ethnic thing. It's about who's come through and played their time in junior cricket. And so, yeah, their off spinner Retoreka, his parents are not Japanese, obviously, but he's sort of lived and grown up there, and so it's good to see them prioritizing their own development, and it's good to see them. I guess Japan has a bit of a reputation for being quite ethnocentric, so it's nice to see the cricket team is inclusive as well, I guess. And I did actually catch up with Dougal Beddingfield a little earlier about the situation in Japan and what it means for Japan to qualify, and so here's Dougal now.
G'day, Nick. Pleasure to be back on the podcast again. Fair to say it's been a big week for Japan cricket.
First of all, congratulations on the result, qualifying for your very first World Cup in any format. Tell us a bit about what this means for Japanese cricket and how are you going to build on this going forward?
Yeah, certainly qualifying for a World Cup is always going to be a game changer. And we're hoping we can develop a lot more interest in cricket throughout Japan and really take cricket from being what might be regarded as a minor sport or a bit of a novelty to something more mainstream, the sport that really appeals to a broader section of the Japan population. Hoping also it might add a little bit to our sponsorship avenues. In terms of the under-19 team that we have, it's actually very young. It's hard to believe, but 10 of the 14 we had that just won the tournament are eligible to go around again in 2 years' time. And we believe we've got a hell of a lot of talent there to work with. So actually going to this World Cup, we're not regarding this as just a one-off thing. We think we can be back even stronger again in 2 years' time after we compete in this World Cup.
Obviously, it's a bit disappointing to qualify by forfeiture, and you certainly mentioned that's not the way you would have wanted to do it, but Japan did play some good cricket throughout the tournament, and you were undefeated going into the last game against PNG. Talk us through the campaign, the preparation, and I guess how did you build to this result?
Yeah, when I look back on when the campaign started, I actually look back to about 5 years ago. I think it was 2014 when I remember having a conversation with the ICC who told us that we weren't going to be allowed into the actual under-19 World Cup qualifying for East Asia Pacific. At that stage, our league structures just weren't good enough, and there are certain requirements for putting a team even in World Cup qualifying. You need a proper under-19 league, and either side of that, under-15 or under-17, plus a good senior system as well. So you've got that whole pathway. So we really went about trying to build that, and it came with firstly building a strong under-15 league, added to that with an under-19 league. So we also had our Cricket Blast program for under-12s. So it took a while to happen, but now we've got the pathway of under-12 cricketers learning with the softball, going into the under-15 league, under-19 league. And that culminated in last year in March when we first put together our under-19 National Academy squad. And we really began preparation formally for this qualifying event, I'd say, yeah, in March last year. So we put together a squad. We've got about 27 in the under-19 squad now. And, yeah, all those boys have been working pretty hard towards the qualifying event. We had some decent players who were actually left out of the 14. So, yeah, we've got a little bit of depth now in our under-19 program.
So how do you rate your chances going into the under-19 World Cup next year?
Yeah, I imagine we'll be favourites to win it now. I think Australia and India will be pretty good too, but yeah, we would be one of Japan, Australia, India, I reckon, yeah. In all seriousness though, We'll take in a similar approach to what we did in this tournament. We weren't going out there saying we're going to win this, we're going to win that. We just aim to be as competitive as possible, really focus on the basics. And what our focus was going into this particular tournament was to just give ourselves every possible chance to just stay in the game for as long as possible. And who knows, by the end of the 100 overs, we might have come up on top. So we'll be taking in a similar attitude to this particular World Cup. And we're well aware of the strength of the other 15 teams who are going to be there.
Sure. And who would you say are some of the key players to watch for Japan, both in helping you qualify and going into the tournament next year?
Probably first of all, I'd have to mention our captain, Marcus Thurgate. Yeah, believe it or not, I first met Marcus when he was a four-year-old, and he was an annoying little brat then, and not much has changed there, but he's now turned into a fine cricketer. I first met his mother and father, who I've been friends with for a long time. And incidentally, his father, Chris, has been an ICC umpire now for a number of years. His mother, Yukiko, has been team manager of the Japan women's team. And his little brother, Ash, is also in was also in our squad of 14. So it's a pretty amazing cricket family there. Marcus made 250s during the tournament, and his glove work was outstanding as well, and a very good leader. The other one, probably a gun player, I suppose, and he's only 15 years old, is Kazumasa Takahashi. He's actually a Sano local. He's been playing cricket since he was 8 years old. Gradually got better and better to the point where he's now a really important player in our senior men's team, not just our under-19 teams. And he's going to continue to get better. There's no doubt about that. So definitely one to keep an eye on. And probably the other two I'd mention are our two spinners, off-spinner Uganda Ritharika and our leg spinner Masato Morita, who were a bit of a handful for a lot of the teams during the tournament, and we expect them to improve as well. They'll play a big part in the World Cup.
Tell us a bit about the organisation of the tournament. It was held at Sano, which is the premier cricket ground in Japan. How did it hold up for a five-team tournament? And I guess, what are the facilities like?
Yeah, Sano's really well set up now to host events like this. So as an associate nation with limited funding, we're actually quite lucky that we have such a good facility. So yeah, we hosted the five-team tournament, and it was definitely a success. But I actually think we're capable of hosting even bigger events in the future. We've got the two grounds right next to each other. The surface was excellent, and the pitches played really well. Even when it rained, our covers held up really well too, and we were able to get on pretty much soon after the rain stopped. So yeah, everything's really well set up. I probably mentioned in the last time we spoke that we're looking for national teams to visit and play T20 internationals. So hopefully we get a few of them in the next few months as well.
Yeah, of course. And this is Japan's best result in any ICC tournament so far. I know the Japan Cricket Association has been trying to build up cricket as part of the culture in Sano. So I guess, what was the reception like at home, and how is the public support throughout the campaign?
Yeah, it's fair to say social media has been going off the hook, both from people within Japan and a lot of well-wishers from around the world who've jumped on and been sending some lovely messages of support to the Japan team. Kind of feel like when we go to this World Cup, we might be everyone's favourite team or second favourite team, and I'm hoping that support really builds and builds as we gear up for the World Cup. In terms of spectators to the ground, you probably don't usually get that many spectators to these under-19 regional tournaments. For the first day, we probably got about 200 fans come along on the Sunday, which was good for us. Not so many on the weekdays, but for us, the media attention that it received within Japan has been really important. And yeah, we're expecting that to build even further as we prepare for this World Cup.
Of course. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Dougal. And it's been a pleasure, as always, to have you on the Emerging Cricket Podcast.
Thanks for having me on again, Nick, and we look forward to plenty of support from the whole team at Emerging Cricket during the World Cup. Thank you very much.
Right, let's head to Europe now, where we have the European ICC T20 World Cup qualifications about to be played. They're being hosted in Guernsey, and we have just seen Jersey and Guernsey play their inter-insular series, which was won 3-0 by Jersey. The first match actually went to a super over, with Jersey prevailing, and then Jersey went on to win the next two games quite convincingly. Before we do get into the qualifiers, we should probably discuss that series that was 1-3 by Jersey. Nick, you did have a look at all the scorecards for this match. It did look like Guernsey might steal that one even in the super over, though. Jersey did come back hitting them strongly. And then, yeah, as I said, there were two sort of dominant victories in the second and third matches. Jersey made 164 and 171 across those two games and won them quite convincingly. Who were the standouts there?
Well, one of the good things for Jersey, I guess, was how multiple players sort of stepped up and contributed. You know, Nick Ferriby back in the team after having last played, I think, in Kuala Lumpur last year in Division 4. He came back and scored 81 in the second match to take Jersey to a pretty dominant total. And Chuggy Purchard, their captain, actually, he wrecked the Guernsey chase with 5 for 17 in that second match. And then the decider was... It was all Dominic Blampier who smashed 43 not out to get Jersey up to that 171 mark and then demolished Guernsey with his leg spin, taking 4 for 20. So, yeah, the wickets and runs sort of all shared around, which was good. Ben Stevens also contributed, and he's going to be a star player for them in the upcoming qualification. I like this series that Jersey and Guernsey have going. It's one of the longest running cricket rivalries around, actually. They've been doing it for years, and it's nice to see them still doing it. And Jersey have been pretty dominant in the last few years, and that is actually the first game in that European qualifiers, the Jersey-Guernsey grudge match, you could call it. So I guess the Guernsey lads are going to want to peg one back and get it over the old rivals.
Just looking at some of the highlight videos, there's a few things that sort of piqued my interest. I noticed that there was a barbecue going on the side of the ground, which did remind me of our trip to Namibia and the briar that was going on, which was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing I noticed was Luke Wright is there in a coaching capacity for Guernsey. I understand his brother is in the team and for the Guernsey side, and I think he had a role high up in Guernsey cricket. I think, Tim, you knew more about that.
Oh, there's a definite connection there. I think they've looked at getting a T20 franchise series going or something like the Sixers, and they're definitely looking to leverage the right connection, shall we call it. So seeing that one of the brothers plays there, who knows, if Luke Wright doesn't play for a couple of years, he may be qualified. We may see him playing for Guernsey if he's living on the island. But if it's the right time for him to be playing for Guernsey, you never know what could happen. But yeah, I know that's definitely been there, and they've got him in there to coach a few times. But I'm assuming just with a bit of a break with his county duties to have them there. So we shall see if that can impact for the qualifiers. But I guess with those three results and as much as home team advantage, which they'd like to take advantage of it. But I don't know, looking at Jersey as a side overall, and I know it was a while ago, but to knock off teams like Hong Kong like they did during the T20 World Cup qualifiers, I guess it was 5 years ago now, was it 2014? A lot can change. But Jonty Jenner, I didn't see his name.
He played the third one, didn't do much.
Okay, well, you know, with a name like Jonty Jenner there, the most famous 12th man, I think, in recent history, with a lot of toing and froing saying that he was that he shouldn't have been doing it, and now he qualifies for England because he was 12th man, etc. But there's still a lot of positive talk about him, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. But I don't know, that classic catch that I saw in the highlights from the Guernsey player, I can't remember his name, but diving back, wasn't quite Stokes, but still one of the better catches that you'll see captured on a little Twitter clip there. I think, was it BBC that were down there?
They do some reporting, I think. The BBC, obviously, they have a presence in the Channel Islands.
Yeah, so I think there's someone there, so down there, which was, yeah, good to see. That was sort of from the official feed.
Jersey and Guernsey actually have, just on that point, they do both run pretty good Twitter feeds, and they do get a lot of, a lot of good engagement and some nice videos and photos and stuff. So two of the better Twitter feeds in associate cricket, let's say.
Well, another one that's going quite well is Germany, who are, I guess, playing in the qualifier as well, and they're one team to probably look out for in the qualifier, although it does appear as if the county guys, Ollie Rayner, Craig Mescada and Dieter Klein, might not be available at one stage. They were named in the squad. Just going through the teams again, Guernsey, Denmark, Germany, Italy, Jersey and Norway. Who do we see taking out this qualifier? It is a pretty tough one, and with the, I guess, potential injection of those county players, Germany probably move up in people's power rankings, but perhaps Jersey maybe just ahead at the moment?
I don't know. Don't forget that Denmark did play World Cricket League Division 3 only late last year, and they did beat Kenya in the last game. And I guess Kenya's sort of fall from grace, but they've now qualified for the global T20 World Cup qualifier. So, look, I'm Unless we see some of those big names come back, there's also a certain ex-CEO of ICC's son who's also eligible to play for Germany, whether or not he's able to make it, young Richardson. But no, I think probably Denmark and Jersey for me, but Denmark is I'm putting my mark down for the Danes.
Well, just mentioning the Danes there, they also pushed the USA pretty hard. They lost, I think, by about 15 runs in that WCL3 tournament you mentioned. And we all know how good the American team is now as well. So they have got some quality players. You know, obviously, Freddie Klocker at the top, the veteran opener, and Hamid Shah, the captain as well. And they have some pretty good bowlers as well. Nikolai Legsgaard is very parsimonious, you might say. Left arm spinner, uses the angle and his height very effectively to really put the brakes on the run rate. And he's especially effective in 2020 cricket. So, yeah, the Danes are a good shout. As you were saying, though, Bez, it's a very open tournament. Yeah, especially if the county guys can make it over for Germany, I think they'll have a pretty solid team. We saw Germany knock off a Netherlands development 11 a week or two ago in a tri-series there with Italy as well, although Germany ended up losing two matches against Italy, but they beat the Netherlands development 11 with Isatullah Dolatzai taking 4 for 18. So again, they have some quality players in their side. I'm not going to tip Germany. I think Jersey probably in the 2020 format have enough firepower with the bat and a lot of quality with the ball, so they're probably the most balanced team. I would tip Jersey just ahead of Denmark.
And let's not forget the Italians either. I think they've been there or thereabouts, and they'll be going around in the Cricket World Cup Challenge Leagues as well. So, and they've always got some good quality players, whether sort of Italian developed or not, with the sort of the tentacles out to the world. So I wouldn't be too surprised if they were up there either. I'm really looking forward to it. I think, as we've seen from the releases, the three tournaments, or at least the two tournaments, sorry, the women's qualifier and the men's T20 World Cup qualifier are all going to be streamed. And did I see a press release saying that they're also going to have sign language during the commentary?
Yeah, it's just going to be the 18th of June, which I believe is some sort of campaign across Europe for, inclusivity of people with accessibility issues. And so they're sort of participating in that. But honestly, this sign language for cricket commentary, I'm not convinced for a number of reasons. The first being that sign languages are different in every country. And the press release says they're going to be doing it in British Sign Language, but that means the Germans, the Danes, the Norwegians, and the Italians won't be able to understand the sign language. So, that seems pretty pointless. And of course, there's a lot of other questions about, if they're paying for this, why, how many cricket sets could they hand out to schools for the amount of money that they're paying for this, and all this sort of practicality stuff. So and the other point is that cricket is a very visual game, so how much really is a sign language interpreter going to add? I'm not sold on this. I think the heart's in the right place, but it just seems like I don't think it's really going to be very effective for achieving much at all, really.
I believe the last 2 minutes may have let everyone know that, Nicholas. But another slight concern that I have is with Andrew Leonard doing the commentary. Are we going to have someone that's going to be able to understand what the man says?
It's a very, very nasty sledge there.
Brutal on cricket badge. I'm apologising on Cutler's behalf for that.
Here's a little test to our friend Andrew Leonard, cricket badge, that to see if you listen to this podcast. I think he may still be ignoring us.
No, I can't wait if he says something like it's a shambles or something like that. It's completely out of like a cricketing sort of vernacular, how the signer would go about that. I think it would be hilarious.
Yeah, I wonder that could provide a bit of interest, just trying to figure out how to say shambles in sign language. But they've got in the former captain of the England deaf cricket team to do the sign language, which is pretty interesting. Umesh Falji, MBE.
I didn't know that. Is he just going to watch the game and sign, or is he going to have the commentary in his ear? Because I guess he's going to have to do that, isn't he?
That's what I was wondering.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Or will the camera be on him watching the game and signing? Because that's an interesting one. Because I assume that they don't speak about it the same way in sign. Would you? How does Nicholas? I think you're a lot more educated on this. Is it still like full English? It's not sort of shorthand in sign language. Is it sort of signed out?
No, so sign language is not English. That's, I guess, a common misperception with sign language. It's not. So sign language speakers are actually all bilingual. Like, it's a distinct language in its own right, and it's not actually like just English with your hands. It's a completely different language, which is, again, why this idea of signing in British, I mean, that's fine for Jersey and Guernsey fans, but all the other teams' fans aren't going to be able to understand him because sign languages are all different. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's the sort of thing, I guess they didn't really think it through very well. But yeah, I think you do raise an interesting question as to whether he's going to be interpreting what Andrew Leonard's saying or if he's going to be providing his own commentary. But yeah, either way, I think it'll be interesting to see how this works.
Yeah, well, just a wrap of some other European cricket that's been going on. Guernsey and the Netherlands development sides have played out a series, as well as a Germany, Netherlands development, and Italy as well. So plenty of cricket going on in Europe. One, I guess, series that didn't materialise was an Austria v Turkey T20 international women's series was cancelled, unfortunately, because the Turkish women were unable to acquire visas for the series, which is hugely disappointing. Just looking at some more European cricket that's going on, Scotland A played against the Island Wolves, of course, their sort of Island A side. Scotland A won the three-match series 2-1. Some highlights for Scotland. Dylan Budge made 132 in their first match. Leask made 110 not out in the second. Was also in the wickets as well. Once again, George Munsey hitting them to all parts of the ground, enjoying his time of it. For Ireland, Shane Gettcate was in the runs. In the second match, he won them the game, actually. And that second match, Lorcan Tucker, Jack Tector all making contributions with the bat, as well as Craig Young with the ball. And Peter Chase as well took wickets, but was quite expensive. For Ireland, it's just been the players coming through that they haven't quite got right just yet, with, of course, the golden generation of Ireland moving on in terms of retirement and other sort of career pursuits. You've seen Niall O'Brien going to commentary after his playing career. So, Tim, it does look like there's a little bit of a transition there for Ireland to get through, but once they do, they should be okay.
Well, yes, you know, they've got first-class status and list A across their inter-pro series, which is great, I guess, for status, but it's a matter of improving the quality coming through there. So I'm not sure what's next on the development pathway, whether they're looking at, you know, like the county seasons way back in the sort of 80s and 90s where Australians came and cut their teeth but also really improved the quality of cricket, whether that's next for Ireland to get in some overseas players to sort of bulk that up. Who knows what's next? But I guess they've also got their challenges off the field.
Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting to see Scotland sort of experimenting a bit with their lineup. You know, Leask scored a ton in the second game, and you know, he was batting up the order, whereas he's normally sort of a bit further down. And also Dylan Budge, who's another one of those, I guess, fringe guys that I think he's played a couple of one-days for Scotland, but yeah, he hasn't really cemented his place. But he was, you know, he was captaining this side, and he scored a big century in the first game. And so, yeah, it's nice to see their, I guess, bench strength kind of coming through. And that's, Tim, you sort of touched on it with the issue of depth. And I think Scotland, one of the things that bodes well for them in the next few years is that, yes, they have a very good team at the moment, but they also have some pretty good guys coming through sort of to maybe replace them in the medium term, kind of 5 years on from now.
And just staying with Ireland, there's been a cyber fraud situation going on in Irish cricket. It's hampered multiple people, businesses and clubs around the country. Cricket Ireland came out and said that they had lost a six-figure sum of money, though other reports have suggested that across Ireland, millions of dollars have been lost, which is an unusual situation. I don't really know what else to add to that. There are plenty of stories circulating. But sticking with Ireland, the Irish women took on the West Indies, with the West Indies rather dominant in their series. Just looking at the scores now, the West Indies, of course, did take out the series 3-0, scored 4 for 139 in their first game, bowled Ireland out for 75. The second match, Ireland put up perhaps a little bit more fight. The West Indies, though, making 157 for 6, with Ireland falling 45 runs short. And in the third game, the West Indies took out that one by 72 runs. A couple of sort of notable performers for Ireland. Difficult to, I guess, pinpoint ones in the first game when they only took 4 wickets and were bowled out for a rather miserly total. In saying that, Kim Garth made 51 in the second match with the bat. And in the third match, there was notable performances from Mary Waldron. She made an unbeaten 55. Kim Garth backed up her total with 45. And with the ball, Sophie McMahon picked up their only wicket actually in that match, which was a little bit disappointing. But once again, it's these series that need to be played out for the development to be made, Nick.
Yeah, and I think Ireland did show a bit of fight, which is good. And you've got to remember the West Indies women, yeah, they are a very good T20 side. You know, they won the T20 World Cup back in 2016, and they have a lot of very good players as well, you know, some real match winners. So I think this is a good experience for Ireland. And as you say, you know, the more teams that stop off in Ireland on the way to England, the better for them as well.
Yeah, as you said, it's a good opportunity for Ireland if teams are going through that sort of part of the world to fit a few more matches in that tour, and for Ireland to even take on the West Indies in a bilateral series there just is hugely crucial. Of course, yeah, as you said, West Indies one of the top teams in the women's circuit, probably second to Australia. India might have a say about that as well, but yeah, a incredibly strong female T20 outfit. Sticking with T20 and the Americas qualifier, with the USA and Canada playing, the USA finishing 3 wins from 3 and advancing to the qualifying tournament. They were pretty clinical in their displays. They held Canada to 66 in the first match, won that by 10 wickets in rather convincing fashion, then set Canada 114 for victory, with Canada falling short by 37 runs in the second match. And in the third match, the USA, almost with an identical scorecard, once again losing 6 wickets, this time for 116. Before Canada finished their 20 overs, 81 for 6, of course, winning that by 35 runs. That means that they qualify for the qualifying tournament, which is held in Scotland, of course, in August and September. And that means that almost every spot has been taken there. Only the European spot is left over. So just running through who will be playing in that qualifier: Bangladesh, Ireland, Scotland, Thailand, Zimbabwe, Papua New Guinea, the United States, and then, of course, the winner of the European qualifier. Pretty clinical performance there by the USA.
Yes, Canada definitely not good enough. They basically just completely outclassed in every discipline, really. The Americans batted with a lot more, I guess, fluency. They had some good start at the top of the order with Erica Rendler, who was a field hockey player previously, I believe, which is an interesting story in itself. Yeah, and the captain, Sindhu Srihasa, topped the run charts as well with 80 and a couple of big contributions there. So their batting was, as I said, too good. And a good story to come out of the bowling side of things for the Americans was Lisa Ramjet, who's a youth product from Maryland and made the local paper. So that got some good local coverage of the game over in Maryland, so that was nice. But yeah, the Canadians just not good enough. They had, I think it was 4 runouts. In one of their games, and then 4 bold dismissals in another. So some pretty basic technical errors that they really should look to address going forward, I think.
Yeah, as you discussed there, Lisa Ramjet, I think I read that she's 14. She's an eighth grader in a Maryland high school, which is craziness.
Jamie Harrison would have surely been on that.
Yes, I believe he was. Shout out to Jamie Harrison. Yeah, to be playing international cricket for your country whilst being a 14-year-old school kid is...
Where were you in 8th grade, Bez?
I cannot comprehend that. But yeah, a thoroughly, I guess, dominating performance by the Americans who, yeah, as we said, do qualify for that global qualifier. Staying in the USA, and we've got an unsavoury situation coming out of the USA in terms of the T20 competitions that have been earmarked for 2021. We've just seen Jay Pandya file a lawsuit against USA Cricket for the handling of the distribution of who is responsible for taking that tournament on. Tim, I'm sure that you might be a little bit more enlightened on this situation.
Yeah, I'd like to say it's interesting, but it's not a little bit distressing, to be honest, to see this, well, in the press first. I'm not sure how often you first hear about these things when lawyers are making, putting out press releases. And as far as I can hear, they're also making contact with certain cricket journalists as well to try and get their story out there, which is a little sort of horse before the cart. But basically, as I think we reported on when it happened, American Cricket Enterprises and a partnership between Willow TV's owners and the Times of India, who own Willow TV, I think actually some of their shareholders got together, and their bid for the T20 League in the USA was successful. Nothing was officially released as to who came second and further down the field. But from Peter Della Penna's reporting, it appears that Jay Pandya, who owns the St. Lucia Stars and only in 2016 signed a $70 million licensing deal with former American cricket body USACA, that was going to be part of a $2.4 billion project to build stadiums across the US and start a professional T20 league. Now, this is poignant, not only because he's still looking to invest in certain places, including Allen in Texas with a $500 million stadium, but part of the suit actually alleges that the ICC at least conspired to expel USACA from the ICC to only stop Jay Pandya's investment in the game. So he's tried to tie the decision to suspend and then expel USACA from the ICC to this lawsuit, where he says that Willow TV granted advertising time gratis to some of the individuals who were running for the board on the new USA Cricket board. And then when it came time to vote for the successful proposal, they would then go with the Willow TV proposal, but it's all very, very messy. We've seen lawsuits come up in the past with former USACA executives or people connected trying to take the ICC or the new board or group to court or to sue them. But I don't know. The challenge here, I think, is whether the court deem USA Cricket a private entity, and in which case they can make commercial decisions however they see fit, as long as there's no fraud that goes into the consideration. But considering they get public money, or do they get public money, is it deemed to be a public tender, in which case I'm sure there are other regulations around transparency of bids and why decisions are taken. So I think that will be the only thing that hinges on. The more I read about it, the sort of more my head spins with some of the allegations. So I think we'll wait and see with that one, with that league looking to get off in 2021 and for over $1 billion to be invested in the first few years across facilities and teams. I think we can all agree that if a league gets going in the US, it'll be massive for world cricket. But behind that, there was also a bid, I think, involving Tim Anderson, former head of global development. Of course, has now been replaced by Will Glenwright at the ICC, but he was working with another American sports marketing firm. Didn't get past the final considerations. It seemed to come down to that Jay Pandya bid, who reportedly had offered quite a few $1 million more to USA Cricket for signing on to their deal up front. But it looks like, well, for various reasons, they've gone with the combined Times of India and Willow TV bid, which, you know, considering the investment made across, well, through Willow TV into the US, and I think it's about the fifth highest TV market for cricket in the world, it would seem that the safe bid.
Yeah, it does seem like a bit of a mess, doesn't it, Tim? Yeah, unfortunately, it's not the first time we've had this sort of, I guess, legal disputes and messy dramas over leagues that are apparently going to happen, but, you know, in the past sort of haven't ended up happening. So hopefully it's not another one of those false dawns. But yeah, I can't say I'm entirely convinced that this is going to end well.
Yeah, well, you've wasted no time there nailing your colours to the mast, Nicholas. So I'll jump straight into the Canadian Global T20. I guess some more frustrating news as well, north of the border. Well, really, potentially in India, actually, because They're moving, of course, the Global T20 to Brampton instead of the King City grounds. They've also scrapped the American team that they were originally going to have in this year's tournament, which again made little sense. And there's also talk that after the draft of the Global T20 has been postponed several times, that they're actually going to hold it in Mumbai, and not the name of a odd Canadian town. We are talking about Mumbai in the nation of India. This tournament's meant to start in just over a month's time, I believe. So a lot of wheels need to be set in motion for it to come into fruition. Do we have concerns that the tournament won't run at all now? Because there's just so many things that need to happen before we see a ball bowled.
Well, I think there's a lot of things to kind of line up that need to be done. But considering it's the same entity that owns the Global T20 Canada and also the Euro T20 Slam, and they were already lined up pretty closely together. Look, I think GT20 in the end was done at a pretty short runway, and it was probably lesser for it, both in the production of the playing surface and outfield and also the stands and everything for media and whatnot. I just hate to think that despite the promises and great proclamations from the mayor of Brampton, which is great, about all the cricket ground developments going on, that there's not going to be a ground to play it on that's up to the standard of the players that will be there. And then running into the Euro T20 Slam, they've got to get three grounds prepared, sell tickets in three different cities. And from the sounds of it, there's a lot of common resources across both events. So, yeah, I'm concerned. I'm hoping that they'll be able to get it done. But, yeah, it doesn't look good, does it?
Well, I mean, yeah, we were worried that the first edition of the Global T20 wouldn't happen as well, but it ended up, I mean, it happened. It certainly, as you allude to, it was a bit rough around the edges, and it seems like the Euro T20 Slam is potentially going to be similarly, perhaps a bit rushed. I mean, yeah, a lot of these decisions don't really make a lot of sense. You know, having an American team in a tournament entirely played in one city in Canada, and then cancelling the American team, and then having a draft in Mumbai and moving the ground to Brampton, which, I mean, they said it was so it was more central, but Brampton is pretty much equidistant from the Toronto CBD as King City was. And last year, they were originally going to try and have the tournament in Brampton to start with, but then the ground in Brampton was asking for too much money for the fee for the use of the ground. So it's all a bit messy again, and it just sort of gives off a slightly just this vibe of, yeah, as you say, will it happen, will it not? It just doesn't look good, does it? And it's disappointing because, yeah, as you say, there's so much potential there, and, you know, they're putting a fair amount of money into the cricket, but it's just sort of, you know, where's the money going? And, you know, what is their end game here? You know, what's the business plan? Because it just sort of seems like a money sink at the moment.
Well, yeah, the Brampton fees for playing games there doesn't shock me, but at the same time, it's pretty disappointing when you've got the potential of having so much exposure by, you know, having your ground as the host of a T20 tournament that will hopefully host quality international players. You'd think that, you know, you'd take any sort of chance you could get to expose yourself to a wider market. Again, going back to the American team, yeah, we actually made a point in the group chat that, you know, you could make a team based wherever, really, if you really wanted to. It didn't really matter. But to have just this sort of American, well, faux American team in your league, it was almost like they were jumping on America's success of ODI status and World Cricket League 2 almost. The timing was very interesting. But yeah, as we've all, I guess, discussed, it's going to take a monumental effort now for everything to come together.
My sources say different, that they're just trying to decide what the name is going to be and trying to sell it. So, you know, I think here we go. This is my prediction for the event, that there's going to be a New York franchise, or at least an icon franchise, potentially New York or elsewhere. And I reckon Yuvraj Singh is going to be announced as the marquee icon star, everything. I'm just been trawling the world, and the Press Trust of India had comments from a BCCI official saying that since he's retired, there'd be no reason for them to say no for him to be able to play in T20 events elsewhere. And Virinder Sehwag had played in T10, Zaheer Khan as well. No one has been approved, no major player. I know we've seen Indians, of course, play in the Everest Premier League and also the Pokhara Premier League in Nepal, but no one of any, shall we say, great standing. But there you go. So there's my prediction that will come out, and there'll be even more money thrown at, you know, there were discussions of over $10 million being pumped into year one. And I mean, over $10 million in the red when it came to the end of it. So there you go. That's what I think is going to happen. And as seems to happen with a lot of these things, everything gets thrown together and there's going to be an event on, like, to what level, who knows. But there you go. There's my thoughts about what's going to happen, that they've been working in the background probably maybe a little bit too hard on trying to make sure that Yuvraj retires and is able to sign. What do we reckon?
Yeah, well, the timing adds up. You make a good point. And you don't really need to be a conspiracy theorist to think something like that, as we saw retiring and then therefore sort of being eligible by, I guess, the Indian code of practice and their way that they go about things. We did see Irfan Pathan nominate for the CPL. I believe he didn't get drafted, but yeah, it all makes sense. And a lot of people out there, upon listening to that, Tim, will probably be quite convinced actually by that.
Yeah, well, he's not yet written to the board, and once he does do that, then only we can consider his case. But since he'll not be playing the IPL, there's little ground for not giving him the permission. Retired players of his stature have been allowed to play outside India. Previously, a BCC official had told the Press Trust of India, amongst other things. So, look, I think it's the stars seem to be aligning from when it was first mentioned. It seemed to be a bit of a flag in the sand, or at least a sort of a sign of what was going to happen. And considering the, you know, fact that Mercury have now been renamed the Bombay Sports Company and the common ownership and what they've been talking about, what the events are going to be. And don't forget, there's still a single icon player left in the Euro T20 Slam. I think Owen Morgan signed on, but I think there's still one more place left that I think we all assumed was going to be AB de Villiers. But if there's still a spot left, you never know what could happen. So I don't have any mail on this. It's just, I can just feel in my bones of knowing and having been involved in the Blitz and knowing how hard we worked to get Yusuf Pathan signed. I say we, Kowloon Cantons were great, but then how it all fell down and he was still playing, of course. But this could be quite the headlines potentially in that these leagues are looking for. We talk about where the value is and the Indian market watching the games, that having a star like Pathan could be the real shot in the arm. At what cost, and whether he comes in as a shareholder, who knows, but it could be very interesting for T20 leagues around the world, and also what other ones will be looking to do if they can coax players to potentially retire to come on as shareholders, or at least major icons of these leagues.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how it's all going to play out with regards to the BCCI's their policy of sort of trying to prevent Indian players from playing overseas in all these leagues and whatnot. So I guess Yuvraj might be a sort of a trailblazer in a way for maybe Indian players in the twilight of their careers who potentially, you know, don't think they'll get another IPL deal, or don't think they'll get back into the national team to sort of pursue that T20 mercenary route, which has been a bit, you know, there's some conditions with the ex-India players. I believe they receive a pension from the BCCI, and if they play in leagues without BCCI approval, the pension, I think, gets cut off. So they do have a way of sort of keeping their players in line. So it'll be interesting to see if anyone kind of follows in Yuvraj's footsteps here and maybe opens the floodgates a bit for Indian players in international leagues.
Well, I'm going to back Cutler's theory there. That he sold me, so... Let's move to Africa now, to the T20 World Cup qualifiers, the finals out there. Namibia were quite dominant, and Kenya sneaked through to get the second spot. Uganda disappointingly missed out. A one-run loss to Kenya was, I guess, ultimately the crucial blow in their campaign. Some poor weather as well in Kampala, of course, Uganda hosting the tournament as well. Botswana overall disappointing. But you have to say, boys, it was quite a dominant performance by Namibia, and fair play to Kenya to sneak through.
Yeah, I think Uganda's going to be quite disappointed. So I think they've had a new CEO in place for just over a year now, I think, and after an interesting situation where there was a tie during their board elections and that the constitution didn't allow for that. They had to go to the lawyers and find out what to do. After that, there's definitely been a lot of effort, and I can see some really intelligently structured sponsorship. Yeah, they've been through the ICC's commercial strategy toolkit program, which, you know, Hong Kong was a pilot, and they've worked, I think, around with Namibia and Nigeria, I think, as well, to try and develop some commercial assets, and that's come off well. So, you know, we've seen they've run some great events that they've been able to stream. I just know they're going to be very disappointed, but I guess if we see Kenya getting better back on the field, it's only good for African cricket and associate in general. But at these tournaments, as we know all too well, you know, only two teams, or sometimes only one team, can progress. So that's just the way it is sometimes.
Yeah, it was tough on Uganda as the hosts, wasn't it? They ran a very good event, really. You know, good streaming, you know, one camera, but very watchable. And it was just a shame that the rain came in. I think it was five matches were just completely washed out, and that's obviously going to stuff up your tournament. Yeah, that one run loss to Kenya is really going to haunt them, I think. They probably should have won that, and I think they were definitely targeting it. And to not get out of this group, I guess, as you say, you allude to there, Tim, Kenya are or have been quite weak recently, so Uganda probably would have fancied themselves to get out of the group. So, yeah, I think they'll be very disappointed. Namibia, obviously, were just too good. They really dominated. The team I was most disappointed with was actually Botswana. You know, they qualified ahead of Namibia from this regional group, but they didn't win a game in this tournament. So, yeah, they were a bit underwhelming. But, yeah, Namibia too good. Nice to see Rakit Patel from Kenya. He's back in the runs. He's sort of one of their long-standing batsmen, and good to see him back in form.
Well, of course, Namibia picking up where they left off in World Cricket League 2 with another, I guess, pretty dominant performance. They managed to squeeze some more cricket in with the Titans, of course, coming to Namibia and playing with Albie Morkel and Pierre de Bron, both playing for their old club. I guess a good hit out for everyone involved, really, with, of course, South African domestic cricket around the corner. With Namibia, though, of course, with one-day international status and a lot more international cricket, I guess just keeping everything sort of full-time is beneficial.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty interesting little exercise, actually. They've got the Titans ascending 10 guys over, with the rest of their team being made up of star schoolboy cricketers, actually. So they'll be taking the field alongside the South African players, and, of course, seeing the Namibian coaching staff playing for their old club there is also pretty entertaining. So it should be a really fun series. They've got a game in Walvis Bay and a game in Windhoek. So going across both sides of the country, and if they can get some streaming up, I'd definitely be interested to check it out.
If only just to see JJ Smith or JP Kotzer just mooing it everywhere.
Unleash the beast.
Yes, Smith can hit.
God, I do hope that they're in the draft for the Euro Slam.
Oh, it'd be silly for a few of those Namibian players not to be in that competition. Would be a bit of a travesty, actually. Just thinking about the all-rounder talent in that team too, like Christy Villiers and Craig Williams could definitely do a job for a team. Actually, to be honest, looking at, you know, their best 11, you could make a case for just about everyone. But coming back to the tour, the Titans arrive on the 26th of June. Of course, they play that T20 match in Walvis Bay on Friday the 28th. With a match at the United Cricket Club on the 30th of June. So they're playing at the United ground, not the, I guess, the main two grounds at Wanderers and Afis before returning to South Africa on the 3rd of July.
To be fair, the pub at United's better.
That's true. It is. It's probably a better setup there. A few more seats and, oh, what a restaurant that is there too. Oh, my goodness. We had quite a feast there that one night.
We had a body weight and pork there, didn't we, across about nine different meals. From a magical animal, Lisa.
Oh, yeah, I reckon I ate a leg weight of food. That was...
Well, remember they did tell us that locally that's referred to and known as the best pitch in the country, and that's where it's been a bit of a fortress for Namibia where they very rarely get beaten. So maybe it's been played there for that reason. But also remembering that Afi's Park is part of the school as well. They're wondering if anything else going on there. But
With rugby.
Anyway, I think we've seen all three facilities and they can all handle it.
Oh, definitely. And the hospitality is good too, so we can vouch for that.
And it's not the first time and probably not the last time we'll mention it.
Well, another African team playing some more regular cricket and unfortunately missing out on the World Cup is Zimbabwe. As a substitute for the World Cup, they are travelling to the Netherlands to play a tour there. They're playing 2 1-day internationals and 2 T20 internationals from the 19th to the 25th of June. So it's a similar time frame actually for the Namibians. Of course, we know the Dutch fairly well with our sort of interactions with several members of the Dutch setup. This is, I guess, a crucial tournament for both teams. I mean, obviously with some more international cricket with context around the corner and both teams, I guess, trying to find the right formula for their teams. This is actually quite a good sort of sparring match, which would we agree with that?
Yeah, the T20 World Cup global qualifiers coming up not too long after this tour, so it'll be a good hit out for them. And both of these teams are in that qualifier, so I guess they'll be sort of sizing each other up. I think the Dutch have a pretty good chance of pulling off a scalp here. They've got a solid white ball team, and if they do, I guess it'll sort of give them a bit of confidence maybe going into the 13-team ODI league, which starts next year, yeah.
Be interesting to see, well, I'm guessing with him being based in Dubai now with his wife who's flying for Emirates, but to see if Graham Creamer will play in this series. We saw how Zimbabwe dismantled UAE, who at that stage we thought were going to potentially come in and give the series a bit of a shake, but that was not to be. So I don't know. They just seem to be improving quietly without too much noise, I guess, at the moment, with a lot of the world looking towards the UK. They can just get on with their work. No, I'm looking forward to the series as well, Nick. I think nail on the head there. And we're hoping to hear some good news about it being streamed too potentially as well, but nothing confirmed. But that'll be really good to see. If so, of course, we played during the day there with no floodlights in the Netherlands. So great sort of watching time for anyone sort of outside of America, really. So that'll be one I'll be trying to watch as much of as I can, just as a lead up to the T20 World Cup qualifiers, as you said.
I suppose that all that's left there is, I guess, a prediction for this series. It's actually, when you think about it, two sides that could potentially be very evenly matched. I might just have the Dutch at home, actually.
Yeah, I'd lean towards Zimbabwe in the 50-over games, but I think the Dutch could get them in the T20s because that's probably their best format.
I was thinking similar. The only thing that will stop a sweep to the Zimbos will be one T20i going to the Dutch.
Well, maybe I'm a little bit too positive. Maybe I'm thinking that Vise can emulate his T20 prowess in a longer format. But
yeah, it'd be nice to see him get going, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it will. Talking to Bertus de Jong in Namibia, apparently Vise has some sort of eye condition, which means his eyesight isn't fantastic, but he sees the ball okay. So, you know, whatever he has.
Whatever he's got, it works for him, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But just to reiterate, first one international starting on the 19th of June, second on the 21st, and then the T20s basically straight away, the 23rd of June and the 25th. Those T20 internationals are considered day-night, but given that they're at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't think the light will be an issue. Boys, I think we're going to have to end today's show there. Another bumper episode. Geez, there just seems to be more jam-packed in every single one the more we go along. To keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platform. And please make sure to give us a positive rating wherever you are listening to your podcast. For now, from us, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world. And make sure to visit emergingcricket.com for all your latest emerging cricket news. Goodbye.